Blog Talk Radio.
With Sonic Effects. Always a pleasure to have you here. We're I'm sitting here with a mug of deliciously strong coffee with a healthy dollop of a chocolate cream liqueur. It just seems to be marginalizing my sleep and stimulating the cells. Here it is, the 16th of April, 2017. It's an amazing day. We've got a good program for you lined up today, I think. Crammed with a lot of interesting ideas. Thank you. I want to take this moment again to thank you for your support. It's pretty amazing. And I'm glad that I'm pleasantly unsurprised. The thought here was that we would start back in 2010. We would start a conversation that the kind that would be uncommon in most lodge rooms, not because of capacity, not because of capability, but because with the busyness of most lodges, there's just not always ample time for this type of contemplation. And where then I realized that I may be in a lodge where, you know, my issues and the questions that I have may not be pertinent to the life and the pulse of the lodge. What then? So rather than let this opportunity slide through fingers, I'm using a bit of a wits and some of the technology available, we began the Sonic Home Companion, and it's evolved today. Thank you for joining us this morning. Anyway, this is an exceptional day. This is celebrating the on this date in 1746, this is a little bit of a plug for everything Graham. This is the date that the Battle of Culloden was fought. And I'll tell you a little bit about why that's significant to the clan Graham. Not everybody in the world is a member of a clan, or at least you don't know that you are. Of course, everybody in the world is a clansman. At one point or another, and so the whole world should acknowledge that once upon a time we were all Celts. Yes, let's admit it. We're all Irish. Welcome to it, eh? Welcome to that. And the Battle of Culloden was important in our family, and I think it's kind of an interesting piece of history. It's the final confrontation of the Jacobite uprising, 1745. A bit of an upstart to Jacobite forces of Charles Edward Stuart. This is a collision between Stuarts and the Hanoverians. And Jacobites had won some battles and were heading toward London in their crosshairs when they decided to pull back, and you can imagine taking over London would have been more than a little significant. But nevertheless, I'm skipping through a lot of history here. Queen Anne had died in 1714. She didn't leave any children, but she was the last monarch of the House of Stuart. So under the terms of the Act of Settlement of 1701, she was succeeded by her second cousin, George I of the House of Hanover, who was a descendant of the Stuarts through his maternal grandmother, Elizabeth. She was the daughter of James V and I, Scotland and England. But the Hanoverian victory at Culloden halted the Jacobite attempt to overthrow the House of Hanover and restore the Stuart to the British throne. And that was the end. Charles Stuart never again tried to challenge the Hanoverian power. And it was fought, the last pitched battle was fought on British soil. Grahams were there. Yep. Between 1,500 and 2,000 Jacobites were killed or wounded. It was a brief battle. I won't bore you with the details, but when you look at the battlefield and the location near the river, you'll see you can see the lack of military sophistication of the clansmen was as apparent. Not the bravery, certainly not. The government losses were lighter, with 50 dead and 259 wounded. But it suggested the deaths were closer to 300 lately, more discovery, geophysical studies, stuff like that. But Cumberland was at the head of the William Augustus, the Duke of Cumberland, was at the head of the British forces, the English forces at the time, and he was later, because of this crackdown on Jacobitism, he was later earned the sobriquet of Butcher. Excuse me, it sort of says a lot right there about the fellow. This did wasn't entirely unfounded. Like the Scots had done what they had to do to win battles, and this was a bit of payback. But on this date, Edward, the king, wanted to suppress all symbols of the independence movement. So he banned the wearing of the tartan. So the Highlands, they were trying to bring the Highland clans under some level of control. No, it wasn't just the Romans that thought they were out of control. So did the English. And there's not a lot of people that would argue with that notion. But to try to bring it back into order, they banned the tartan. And one of the claims to fame, I guess, for ignobly, is that the ban went on until 1782. When George IV began wearing it, a Graham petitioned the English Parliament, leading to a vote that decriminalized the symbol of Scottish independence and Culloden. And that's how the tartan was legitimized again, reevaluated, decriminalized once again. And we're talking about a different, not the colorful little plaids and notions that we have today, but nevertheless, material that was a symbol of community and culture. And so there you have the importance of this date, Battle of Culloden, to the House of Stuart and the Hanoverians and to Grahams. People like me. So thank you very much for your attention to that. Can't get through the day without that little tidbit, could you? No, not a bit. So we'll leave that. Does James I play a hand in the development of masonry? Ooh, that's a little prickly pear, isn't it? Do we plunge into the root of the discussion about the source and beginnings? We can modify history, but you know, I'm part of a lodge registered with the Grand Lodge of Canada, you know, do I want to plunge into the development of masonry in Scotland? Well, of course I do. Don't be ridiculous. So we're here, you know, Masonic effects. We want to carefully and respectfully challenge populism. The popular notion, the simplistic notion. Yeah, I want everything simplistic. I love simplicity. It just doesn't seem to come the way of, it doesn't seem to follow the notions of masonry at all, not at all well. So we have some good music, some good reads. Today we're going to showcase, I think, one of the greatest writers and perhaps the most understated genius of all time. And it's a Russian. Yeah, it's Leo Tolstoy. That's how we say his name in English anyway. This, I think, is quite important for Masons to cultivate the mind, your mind. Reading things branded Masonic seems to me quite odd. Of all of the science that's been happening, taken place in the past, and all of the science that is continuing to emerge today, including the new, you know, the excitement going on about exploration of the human brain and mind. We've had the advantage of inspired and creative minds pulling together information out of their own solitude and contemplative nature, perhaps. And we've benefited from that. So when somebody would say, this is the stack of material that you're to read in order to be able to develop character, one has to question the motive. It does seem a bit short-sighted in so many ways. But if you were a bit suspicious, you could think that this is produced to try and manufacture a particular viewpoint, to sustain, artificially sustain ideas. Now, I don't think masonry at all needs that. I think masonry has very deep foundations, arts and sciences and philosophy. And I hope you agree that we have a need for organization, clear organization, but we also have an appetite for answers. So that suggests that we're posing the important questions, questions of import in the course of a man's life, a man who understands the value and appreciates the worth of character. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit. It's very, very important that we pull together some of these ideas. What would Tolstoy say of this? Well, Tolstoy was very important to him. One of his fascinations was the material written by Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, sorry, who was one of the founding fathers of the United States. Now, I'm not suggesting for a moment that we divide ideas into continents or political lines. I think that's gone on way, way too much. You know, that being the case, we're all going to be stuck in this Reaganist kind of notion that ketchup is a food. That's what he did to poor kids, yeah. But Tolstoy, one of the great writers of Russian literature, very controversial to this day, yeah, was fascinated with the works of Thomas Jefferson. I'm going to talk to you about why I'll read these elements to you. He was a self-improvement junkie, it said. about Tolstoy. And this was inspired in part by the 13 virtues Benjamin Franklin spelled out in his autobiography. So Tolstoy created a seemingly endless list of rules by which he aspired to live. Some of those rules, that type of notion, trickles into Masonic thinking. You know, treat all people fairly. There's an equality in the world if you look for it. And then there's some interesting quotes about we can do a lot of things, but we can't cure stupidity. Well, things like that. He would create these rules. You can see he was preoccupied and always striving to improve, which I think I like. I would perhaps admire that part of the man in a way. He would be in bed by 10 and up at 5 with no more than a 2-hour nap. He ate moderately and avoided sweet food. These are the insights of a lifelong struggle with his personal demons, his desire to limit his brothel visits to just 2 a month. This is a man that began to live a life of celibacy. And there's a self-admonition over his youthful gambling habits. Youthful being the source of that notion. He would sporadically keep a journal from his late teens, we know about, called A Journal of Daily Occupations. And in detail, he would account for how he spent his day, clearly plotting out how he intended to spend the following day. As if that wasn't enough, he had an ever-growing list of moral failures. This is a man who was able to examine himself and even found time to create guides governing everything from listening to music to playing cards while he was in Moscow. Anyway, in 1862, he was only 34 years old. He married an 18-year-old named Sophia Bears. She was the daughter of a court physician. And they got married just a couple of weeks after they met. And that same year, if you can imagine, this is, we can only presume that his marriage and his love for this woman was inspirational, because he sat down and began to work on War and Peace. And the first draft he finished 3 years later in 1865. He began revising and rewriting, as writers are prone to do, some writers. And his wife, Sophia, was responsible for writing each version by hand. And she would use a magnifying glass to decipher her husband's scribble. And every bit, he would do all the scribble in the margins and between the lines. You know what that's like when you see somebody editing your work. For the next 7 years, she rewrote the complete manuscript 8 times and some individual sections nearly 30 times. This is a remarkable woman. During that period, during those 7 years, she gave birth to their 4 of the couple's 13 children, managed their estates and business affairs. And for this, following the successful publication of his next novel, Anna Karenina, in the 1870s, the Russian Orthodox Church excommunicated him. And it goes on. He inspired a cult and Gandhi. You need more? Tolstoy and his wife had one of the worst marriages in literary history. She was invaluable. He made her read his diaries, and it was all full of everything from premarital sexual exploits the night before their wedding. It was unvarnished. She was not a happy woman. So in 1910, she wanted the royalties from his writing to come to the family, and he wanted to give it to humanity. They just fought. So in 1810, he was 82 years old. He ran away, middle of the night, with one of his daughters. He settled on a small parcel of land owned by his sister, disappeared. And when he showed up at a railway station a few days later, so did a news crew. Huge crowd and his wife. He refused to go home, and on the 20th of November, 1910, after developing pneumonia, he died. He died. Everyone thinks of changing the world, but no one thinks of changing himself. If you look for perfection, you'll never be content. I think if it is true that there are as many minds as there are heads, then there are as many kinds of love as there are hearts. Respect, he said, was invented to cover the empty place where love should be. We can know only that we know nothing, and that is the highest degree of human wisdom. Spring is the time of plans and projects. And you've heard us talk here about living in the moment as a Mason. If you want to be happy, says Mr. Tolstoy, if you want to be happy, be. In the name of God, stop a moment, cease your work, and look around you. We'll come back to that. Yeah. Here's something that universal music that pulls us all together. A shout out to our friends and listeners in Poland and in Norway and of course across Canada and the United States. This is the world music in the Masonic effects sense of the word. Wayne Shorter, it's called Footprints. Check it out. This is with Herbie Hancock and Reginald Workman and Joe Chambers. Thank you. Too shabby, not too shabby at all. So what's not to like, right? Wayne Shorter. The commentary today, short, a bit pithy, I would say. What synergies? You know, we talk about synergies within masonry. What synergies? Every day is a good day to be a Mason. Seeking the secrets of life, never knowing if we have the capacity. Would we understand if we made a discovery? Would we really grasp it? Are our truths so dominant? Is it possible another will confront me with their truth and be right? It's a good day, but it's a challenge to be a Mason. Unless we just want to dumb it down and become sort of, I don't know if I'm being terribly unfair. You tell me, gentlemen, is it terribly unfair that I react to masonry being summed up on a bumper sticker? I think it's just the form of it, you know, to make good men better. Making good men better, I think, seems almost a little glib in some. Periods of my thinking. It is a lifestyle, but it's a state of mind. It's all of the pomp and circumstance. It's the work and ritual. It's the highs and it's the lows. It's real. But it is, after all, a state of mind for some. And that really separates out the reality of the statements. There are some with capacity and capability. We're really not talking about whether you can pick up a weight from the ground. We're talking about intellectual capacity, the capacity to think in abstraction and to realize, and a capacity to remember and, you know, to be thoughtful. Does it make a person better to be that way? Well, Masonically, we say it does. But we also say that performing good deeds is another way of accomplishing those insights. And here what separates our thinking, I think, gentlemen and ladies, it's the separation in thinking is between what we know and what we understand. And now science is able to pose the fact that some evidence that we know more than we can understand. And the question, of course, is how is that possible? How is that possible? But it's a phenomenon. We know that we're just literally scratching the surface of understanding the human mind. And it has these little processes, very remarkable processes that we've experienced, but we've never been able to describe. And that knowledge is ongoing. And like all knowledge, like all science, it evolves. So point your fingers at us and say, is this the end of the knowledge? Is there an evolving truth? Well, I think facts, understanding and appreciating facts is also an act of faith. Fact is what it is. Beliefs, on the other hand, tend to change. But when we believe something is the truth today, I believe that the earth is at the, you know, have a heliocentric sense of the universe. That sun, as I bear witness, moves around us. It comes up in the morning and disappears in the evening. And then when we begin to understand the dynamics of orbit and our location in space, then we begin to ask questions about gravity. How are all those things up there? I put an apple in my hand and let go, and it falls onto the lawn. How is that possible? What is that? What is that pull? And is it greater in some places than others? Is it greater on me than it is on you? Well, science evolves. It's a constant process of refinement, and we know that as fact. So the dogmatic amongst us will quarrel and squabble about change. I will not change. We do not like change. And we can do little when there is that conviction. We recognize it for what it is. We can do little to persuade or change, or to persuade that mind to think otherwise. However, the interesting part of that kind of a statement is that it never inhibits change. You know, Masonically, we may be charged or challenged to resist innovation. Well, we resist innovation in our work as a deliberate process, but we enjoy the benefits of the evolution of the work. Ritual, the meaning of ritual, has changed over time. I think deeper, not at a loss of what was before, but with a greater depth. We've had more time to examine. And some of the writers, you will admit, some of the authors of authorship and the minds that have accumulated in masonry in the past have been remarkable. And they've given us some insights that are undeniable. So here's what I want to talk to you about: the fascination of self-improvement of Leo Tolstoy. You know, is it really possible to tell somebody else what one feels? So you wonder, we look at a painting together, and you tell me this is the most beautiful part of that painting. And I look at it and claim that is the most beautiful part of that painting. Is there a right and a wrong? Is there a right and wrong? The two most powerful warriors, are patience and time. He says in Anna Karenina, love. The reason I dislike that word is that it means too much for me, far more than you can understand. Something that's sunk very deeply into my character. This is from the Confession of Leo Tolstoy, Religious Theology. Wrong does not cease to be wrong because the majority share in it. He says, if in War and Peace, if everyone fought for their own convictions, there would be no war. Here, listen to this. This is how to develop your character. Benjamin Franklin's 13 virtues, the fuel for that inspired and confirmed, I would suggest, the questioning mind of Leo Tolstoy. He resolved to always do right and to avoid any wrongdoing. And in order to accomplish this, he came up with a list of 13 virtues that he would strive to live up to. So here's how they read. He committed himself, and think about this, in terms of your applying yourself, temperance, eat not to dullness, drink not to elevation. So the first virtue selected by Franklin was not to overindulge in food or drink. He writes that he selected temperance first because it tends to procure that coolness and clearness of head, which is so necessary where constant vigilance was to be kept up. And the second, silence. Speak not but what may benefit others or yourself. Avoid trifling conversation. By adopting this virtue, Franklin wished first to gain knowledge, which he noted one acquires by using the ears instead of the tongue. Second, he wanted to break a habit he was getting into of prattling and punning and joking, which made him only acceptable to trifling company. Ouch. This is the third virtue, order. Let all your things have their places. Let each part of your business have its time. Talking, I think, about priorities. By achieving order, Franklin expected to be able to have more time for the pursuit of studies and other projects. And he explains that the precept of order requires that every part of business should have its allotted time. So that means we have to be, he's suggesting we be conscious of all of the duties and obligations that we have in our business life. And efficiency will give us more time for our studies and other projects that we desire. Resolution was the fourth. Resolve to perform what you ought. Perform without fail what you resolve. Here's what Franklin had to say about the virtue of resolution. Resolution, once habitual, would keep us firm in our endeavors to obtain all the subsequent virtues. The virtue of resolution can be summed up: if you say you are going to do something, do it. Frugality, the fifth, make no expense but to do good to others or yourself. That is, waste nothing. And the sixth, industry. Lose no time. Be always employed in something useful. Cut off all unnecessary actions. He explains his inclusion of frugality and industry in his list of virtues like this. Frugality and industry, freeing me from my remaining debt and producing affluence and independence, would make more easy the practice of sincerity and justice. And he went on to explain this. Sincerity. Use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly. And if you speak, speak accordingly. Speak sincerely. Use no hurtful deceit. Think innocently and justly. So all those smug little rascals, gee, it sucks to be you. It's such insincerity, you would say. Nothing innocent, just so cynical. The next virtue, number eight, wrong none by doing injuries or omitting the benefits that are your duty. The ninth, moderation. Sounds a little bit like the first, doesn't it? Avoid extremes. Forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. We've spoken about this in Masonic Effects. Do you ever notice the trigger? Somebody has wronged us, and we know in our minds, in our little boy's mind, that we should turn the other cheek. But we often use it as an excuse to retaliate. Somebody causes us offense. It's the excuse, the pettiness, to be petty. Forbear resenting injuries so much as you think they deserve. So even when we think that person deserves my vitriol, a person of character would not do that. And I think this is enormously, monstrously difficult. I was raised in a small community where you were, there was no restraint. Whatever came into your mind, however feeble it was, it came out of your mouth without thought about the effect it would have on the people around. So of course it came out coarse and unpleasant, but you were being taught to sturdy yourself. Just expect that kind of, you wouldn't even call it insult, that frankness, that coldness. And does that have an effect? Well, up to a point. If you examine or understand those notions within yourself, then it's quite simple to remedy. Cleanliness. Tolerate no uncleanliness in body, clothes, or habitation. That's number 10. Get it together. Keep your place. Get your kit together and make your place look proud. Eh? Proud of ownership. The 11th, he says, was tranquility. Be not disturbed at trifles or at accidents, common or unavoidable. I guess in a way, I'm thinking that we're talking here about a contemplative state of mind. So that insight that causes the Buddha to smile, that understanding, that constant smile. The world is rid of conflict and accident, but there's an inner peace that can be undisturbed by those events. And those events in this state, in this reference, are considered trifles. Yeah? Be not disturbed at trifles. So perhaps what Jefferson is talking about here is our ability to discriminate between those things that are trifles and those things that are most important and make decisions. What's important enough to take me out of my tranquility, my peace of mind, my centeredness, my living in the moment? The 12th is chastity. Rarely use venere, but for health or offspring. Never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. Venery. He's talking about doing the nasty. Do it for health or to have children. Never to dullness, weakness, or the injury of your own or another's peace or reputation. Perhaps here he's also talking about discretion. And the last, humility. Yes, every Mason knows this one. Only he operationalizes it. Imitate Jesus and Socrates. Here's what he said about that. My list of virtues contained at first but 12, but a Quaker friend having kindly informed me that I was generally thought proud, that my pride showed itself frequently in conversation, that I was not content with being in the right when discussing any point, but was overbearing and rather insolent, of which he convinced me by mentioning several instances, I determined, endeavoring to cure myself, if I could, of this vice or folly among the rest, and I added humility to my list, giving an extensive meaning to the word. So he didn't just Have at it, gentlemen. He wisely decided not to tackle all of the 13 virtues at once, and instead he would concentrate on one at a time. And he had a method developed to attain mastery over the 13 virtues. And he said, I made a little book in which I allocated a page for each of the virtues. I ruled each page with red ink so as to have 7 columns, one for each day of the week, marking each column with a letter for the day. I crossed these columns with 13 lines, red lines, marking the beginning of each line and the first letter of one of the virtues on that line, and in its proper column, I might mark by a little black spot every fault I found upon examination to have been committed respecting that virtue on that day. He was picking up the flaws, mindful, temperance, order, frugality, sincerity, justice, moderation, cleanliness. And he had it broken down by days of the week. Interesting little map, a little chart. And then I determined to give a week's strict attention to each of the virtues successively. Thus, in the first week, my great guard was to avoid every the least offensive against temperance, leaving the other virtues to their ordinary chance, only marking every evening the faults of the day. Thus, if in the first week I could keep my first line marked T, clear of spots, I suppose the habit of that virtue so much strengthened and its opposite weakened, that I might venture extending my attention to include the next. And for the following, we keep both lines clear of the spots. Proceeding thus to the last, I could go through a course complete in 13 weeks and 4 courses in a year. He was one of the first people, was Franklin, to recognize that recording your behavior helps you to change it. In fact, he turned self-development into a science by observing, monitoring, and measuring his behavior. So you can go on the internet and you can download his footsteps and his chart of virtues, and you can put your glue your chart into your daily planner and always carry it around with you, just like Franklin did. Instead of using a notebook, you can use your iPhone. There's a virtues app. Yeah. So this is the product of a man at the age of 79 writing his autobiography, that he never did achieve his goal of attaining perfection. However, he did achieve the following. Though I never arrived at the perfection I had so ambitious of obtaining, but fell far short of it, yet I was, by the endeavor, a better and a happier man than I otherwise should have been if I had not attempted it. Like that. I do. Here's little Bill Evans. Yeah, I'm toying with you a bit. It's from his album, Time Remembered. Thank you. How did that work for you? Hope it answered some questions and opened some doors and filled a gap, filled a need. I certainly hope so. We're so fortunate to be Freemasons. Remember, I think perhaps you agree that we are in a constant state of renewal, constantly. Freemasonry isn't about stopping and starting and changing. No one mind can change something as expansive as Masonry, but there are tendencies within it that come and go. Different pressures, different influences that happen at certain points in time. Not to be feared, but to be, and not to be endured, but to be explored and to be anticipated. They are what they are. Whether you and I refer to them as vacillations between liberalism and conservatism, whose version of those things are we going to use? Well, of course it's going to be mine, or of course it's going to be yours. So you and I know our minds, and we know certain truths, but could we meet a man with his, who knows his mind with certain truths that don't agree with mine? And then what are we going to do? What to do then? So these pressures that come and go, you know, now we're facing larger questions about, you know, economic theory. Capitalism, the trickle-down theory doesn't work. We know that. We see the polarity between the obscenely rich and the utter dire poor. We never intended to do that, but we have to get out of a sort of a post-colonial thinking that the people with power can assume the control of resources and wealth, and the rest are subject to working within that system that perpetuates. It is a matter of talent. Are we going to see a universal income? Well, we're examining those questions, particularly here in Canada and some other places in the face of the earth, particularly here in Ontario. And it's an interesting dialogue that comes about. It's to do that would not be without effect. And right now, we're not too sure how to control or manage the effect. But we're still thinking that it may be more precarious than what we have right now. And what we have right now is not satisfying. So if more people live the way Masons did, if you say you're going to do something, do it. If you're going to help somebody, help them. Don't be, the way to help is to listen to people. Don't cheapen the experience of being around us. When we're caught out, it's when we're not being true to our convictions. And there are those amongst us who live that way. We can do very little about that. Just like we can do very little about the global scheme of Masonry that's evolving. Masonry now has a global narrative and a global context. Yeah, maybe that's just the product of those pictures back in the 60s. The first pictures from outer space of this beautiful blue and white circle hanging in the darkness. Mm-hmm. I hope we've stimulated you a little bit. If we don't believe in freedom of expression for people we despise, then we don't believe in it at all. Noam Chomsky. Oh, he's not popular with the right or the left. He's just far too independent. And he has, he's opinionated. He's opinionated. If there was an observer on Mars, he said, they would probably be amazed that we have survived this long. So can we just assume that we're just this naive, innocent little group moving through space like a pebble on the bottom of a brook, bouncing. Censorship, he says, is never over those who have experienced it. It's never over those for those who have experienced it. It is a brand on the imagination that affects the individual who has suffered it forever. The independence of your thinking really rests on your sense of character, your sense of value. Not what other people tell you. That's, of course, the development of a mature Masonic mind, the real Mason in you. It's been an absolute pleasure having you join us today. We'll send you off with a little bit of music by Andrea Motis. Andrea is just a remarkable trumpet player, and she's joined with by Joan Chamorro Quintet and Scott Hamilton. Look forward to being with you again next week. Thanks for your time, brother. It's a pleasure. This is called I Fall in Love. Ah, that ubiquitous word again. I fall in love.
home.